Today's first reading is from 2 Samuel. David returned to bless his household, but Michal, the daughter of Saul, came out to meet David and said, "How the king of Israel has honored himself today, uncovering himself today before the eyes of his servants' maids, as any vulgar fellow might shamelessly uncover himself." David said to Michal, "It was before the Lord who chose me in place of your father and all his household to appoint me as prince over Israel, the people of the Lord, that I have danced before the Lord. I will make myself yet more contemptible than this, and I will be abased in my own eyes, but by the maids of whom you have spoken, by them I shall be held in honor." Our second reading is from 1 Corinthians. "To the weak I became weak, so that I might win the weak. I have become all things to all people, that I might by all means save some. I do it all for the sake of the gospel, so that I may share in its blessings." The word of God for the people of God.
I invite you to take out your outline for the message this morning. We're down to our next to last in this series on John Wesley and the history of the Methodist movement in its early days in England. I'm going to cover a lot of territory this morning, so I may preach fast, which will require you to listen fast. So I'll talk fast, you listen fast, and hopefully we'll get through everything today. I want to begin with this picture. This was painted by Kenneth Wyatt in 1984, and it was commemorating the 200th anniversary of the event that took place in this picture. This is John Wesley on the shores of the Avon River, just down from the city of Bristol, where in 1784, he commissioned Thomas Coke to come to America and ordain some of the circuit-riding preachers to be pastors. Now, that was an important event because that meant that the Methodist movement was now a separate denomination, at least here in America. It became a church first in the United States, and so Wesley sends Coke to do that, which says that the church or this movement had expanded in a big way. But this picture is a powerful scene there in the village of Pill in England, because Thomas Coke was a protege of John Wesley. This was his mentor. He would never see him again. And so he asked Wesley, "What do I tell them?" And Wesley says, "Offer them Christ, Thomas. Offer them Christ." Kenneth Wyatt painted this portrait with the title of it, "Offer Them Christ." Now, that means in less than 50 years, the Methodist movement had gone from John Wesley's personal conversion to something that now spanned across Great Britain, Europe, and here in America. Thousands upon thousands of people are now a part of this movement. How did it spread so fast? That's what we're going to talk about today. I want to back up just a little bit and remember a couple of the important spiritual influences on the Methodist movement that were very formative. The first was the Moravian influence. We've talked about that a little bit in the series so far. Going back to John Wesley's time in America, Moravians influenced John with this idea that faith is not all up here. It's not just about believing. It's about experiencing, opening up your heart to this transforming message of good news in Jesus Christ. That is what led to his conversion. Now, Wesley also took the organization of the Moravian Church and applied it to Methodism and grouped people in societies. Later, he then developed class meetings like we talked about last week. Now, the Moravian Church was a big influence in my life. The Moravians settled in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, and somewhere in the early to mid-1700s, they moved south. Moravians didn't just fan out. They moved and stayed in community. So they came to North Carolina and formed the village of Salem, which is today Winston-Salem. And the old village of Salem, it's now called Old Salem, has been restored right in the heart of downtown. Every day, people dress up in their 18th century attire and sort of conduct the village just like it would have been almost 300 years ago. When I was a kid growing up, I had friends in the Moravian Church, and they invited me to play in their brass bands, which at special times of the year, Thanksgiving and Christmas, we would play the hymns in the services. We'd start outside as people came into church. They would hear the hymns as they're coming in, and this was very formative in my upbringing. An important tradition in the Moravian Church is the love feast. On Christmas Eve, when you come in, you get a beeswax candle that is still made the same way it was hundreds of years ago. And during the service, in the middle of the hymn singing, women dressed again in the 18th century attire come out and they pass out mugs of coffee and a roll that's kind of like a cinnamon roll, not like our cinnamon roll with icing on it, but it's just a flavorful bit of bread, and it's just part of this communal experience called a love feast. You can see a picture of a love feast at Wake Chapel on the campus of Wake Forest University. Very special experiences where I grew up in Winston-Salem. And other traditions like the Moravian star, people hang them over their doorways at Christmas time. That is a Moravian star. I have seen a few here in Indianapolis. And if you've ever seen one, that's what it goes back to. It is the Moravian influence. And then my favorite Moravian tradition, sugar cake that is baked in the brick ovens at the bakery in Old Salem. That is such good stuff right there, sugar cake. So, you know, when I was in seminary learning about the history of the Methodist Church and John Wesley's influence by the Moravians, I felt this affinity. That's my story. The Moravians influenced me. Now, the second important spiritual influence on early Methodism was the Great Awakening. The Great Awakening. A spiritual revival that swept England in the 1730s and 40s. And one of the leaders of the Great Awakening was an incredible preacher named George Whitefield. George Whitefield went back to the Holy Club days at Oxford. He was in that small group with John and Charles Wesley. He went on to become this phenomenal evangelist preacher, doing very unorthodox things like going outside of the church to hold services, going where the people were, out into the coal pits and the streets and the villages, preaching where crowds would show up. Now, George Whitefield maintained a close friendship with John Wesley. And in 1739, when he decided to come and bring the revival movement to America, he asked John to come to Bristol, where some of these largest gatherings were happening. And he said, "Will you preach for me while I am away?" And this was the second important influence of this Great Awakening on Methodism: open-air preaching. Open-air preaching. Listen to a couple of entries from John Wesley's journal. This is March 31st, 1739. "In the evening, I reached Bristol and met Mr. Whitefield there. I could scarcely reconcile myself at first to this strange way of preaching in the fields, of which he set me an example on Sunday. I had been all my life so tenacious of every point relating to decency and order that I should have thought the saving of souls almost a sin if it had not been done in church. In other words, Wesley was stepping way outside of his comfort zone by doing this. But then he took his big step 2 days later. Listen to what he wrote. At 4 p.m, I submitted to be more vile and proclaimed in the highways the glad tidings of salvation, speaking from a little eminence in a ground adjoining to the city to about 3,000 people. Wesley had never preached to 3,000 people in his life. He had probably never preached to 300 people at one time before that day, but he submitted to be vile, to do something other people would have said to him. This is outlandish. You're too respected of an individual to lower yourself to such a thing. But he did. Stories are told that in places where Wesley preached, like Hanum Mount, the little eminence in the ground he's talking about, this is that place in Bristol. Today, there's a platform with a railing to mark that spot. And I took this picture when I was there last month with other pastors, looking through a cross in the railing out over the rooftops of Bristol. And I can imagine John Wesley went to that place and he looked out over those rooftops and would have wondered, does anybody care about the people who live under those roofs? Are there churches that are satisfied to say, we don't care if they ever darken our door? We're just fine if all of these people are not connected to the saving grace of Jesus Christ. That's good with us. And I believe Wesley would stand on that place and his heart would break. And he would preach and the people would come. And this was an area known for its coal mining population, a rough lot of people there. Stories are told that the coal miners would listen to this simple message that Christ died for them. And people said you could see the tears cutting streaks in the coal soot running down their faces. People would cry. They would shout. They would clap. They would sing. They would share emotion. And this led to the third important influence of Methodism because of the Great Awakening. Methodists got called enthusiasts. The word enthusiast literally means full of God. But it was a derogatory term by the many people who used it against the Methodists. It was a way of calling them fanatical. They were a bunch of fanatics. They were holding these services outside of the church, out in the fields where people would cry and shout and get emotional and get carried. They're just a bunch of enthusiasts. That's the Methodist. You know, when I read the history about that time and try to imagine, what were those services like? I remember going to an all-African-American United Methodist church some years ago. At 8 a.m. for their first service, 2,000 people were there before the service started, 2,000 people. And when the preacher started preaching, as he got into the message, the congregation started talking. They started amening. They started talking back to the pastor. People started getting up and pointing their finger at the preacher. That's right, that's right. Others started clapping their hands, and I'm sitting there, only white boy in the crowd, going, ah, this is different. And at first, it felt vile to me. It felt vile because this is not how I behave in church. And you know what happened to me? I started getting into it. I started clapping. I started crying. I stood up and joined in with everybody. And I went away and I went, oh man, I love that. I love that. That was powerful. I think those early Methodist services were something like that. Something that the majority of the sophisticated church crowd of that day would have said, that's vile. But because John Wesley submitted to be more vile, he found that thousands of people were being reached with the message of good news that would not have been reached otherwise. I liken it to the story of David we heard a moment ago. When King David led the procession bringing the Ark of the Covenant, where the Ten Commandments were kept, into Jerusalem to be placed in the temple now, David led the procession and he danced before the Lord. And his dancing got so carried away, his robes started flying up, and they didn't wear BBDs back in those days. And when he got home, his wife let him know about it. And she said, "Oh, how the king has disgraced himself today." I love David's response. My dancing was before the Lord. And when it comes to expressing to God what God means to me, I'll be more undignified than that. I believe that's what John Wesley found. What happens in these Methodist services is something so powerful that people feel it. They don't just think it. They feel that God really does love me, that I have hope for my life, that I can be a new person, that God wants to do something significant through my life out there in the world. Oh, I'll be more undignified than this if I can help people experience that. So what happened in those services that was so powerful? What happened in those early Methodist gatherings that allowed people to experience that? One of the first things that happened is vibrant worship. Vibrant worship. Music was critical to those early Methodist services. We've not given as much attention as we should so far to John Wesley's brother, Charles. He was as significant for Methodism as John was. He started the Holy Club. He was a magnificent musician. So what he did was he wrote hymns to go with the theology being preached so that people would sing about this amazing love and grace. The hymn the choir did a moment ago, "Oh, how can it be that I should gain an interest in my Savior's blood?" That's one of, to this day, it's one of the favorite hymns in Methodism in Great Britain. And when people sing it, they throw their heads back and they just shout to heaven because it comes from somewhere deep inside. That's why I stood up, because I just wanted to join in that hymn that is so powerful in our faith. Charles Wesley wrote some 6,500 hymns in his lifetime. We sing many of them today. A lot of them are in our hymnal, not nearly 6,500, but hymns like "Oh, for a Thousand Tongues to Sing" at Christmas, "Hark the Herald Angels Sing" at Easter, "Christ the Lord is Risen Today." Did you know that John Wesley gave us directions on how to sing? Did you realize that? Take out your hymnal. If you can find your hymnal in front of you, turn to one of the first pages in the hymnal. It's Roman numeral 7, "Directions for Singing," written by John Wesley. He said, "Learn these tunes before any others. Sing them exactly as they're printed here. Sing all of them." And I love number 4, "Sing lustily and with good courage." But then he says, "Sing modestly and don't bawl. Sing in time. And above all, sing spiritually. Have an eye to God in every word you sing." Why was it so important? When people came into the Methodist gathering and they started singing, their defenses came down. And by the time the sermon happened, folks were open to receive. Why? Because now their emotion is in it. Now their spirit is invested. Another key feature of these early Methodist gatherings that was so powerful: preaching with conviction. Preaching with conviction. John Wesley and early Methodist preachers were unashamed about preaching the gospel of Jesus Christ. And they focused on God's saving power through Christ. They were just simple, direct, and clear that we need to be saved from sin. That sin is something that can wreck our lives. And a lot of times people say, you know, I don't hear a good sermon on sin anymore. What happened to it? I guess we don't have a problem with it anymore. But the Methodists would talk about it. And you know what would happen to people? They didn't get offended. They would say, I need that help. I need that hope. I mentioned last week my friend Adam Hamilton's book on the Methodist revival. It's called Revival. And we sold out of the first copies, didn't we, Kelly? But you've got more now. So we've got these in the bookstore, and I highly recommend it to you. I believe everybody in the church today should have a copy of Revival to read and understand the work of the church. In this, I love the way Adam talks about sin. He said it's like a car he had one time that was out of line. The steering alignment was out of line, and it always pulled to the right. He said if he ever took his hands off the wheel for just a moment, the car would nearly be in a ditch. And the whole time he drove, he could feel it pulling, and he would have to go get the alignment work on. Otherwise, it'd wear the tires down, and other bad things could happen to the car. And he said that's how sin is. Sin is like this force in our lives that inside of us, it's wanting to veer us off course, to be the people we're not meant to be. Early Methodists would talk about that. And they'd be very clear that when you seek to allow Christ to come into your life, that power is combated. You get help for that power, and there's hope, and you can be saved. It's not just about going to heaven. It's about everything that happens between now and heaven. And people would just be overwhelmed with just the hope of that possibility. People who would say, my life's in the ditch. If that can get me out, I'm all for it. And one more very important feature of early Methodism, there's a passion for people. There is a passion for people knowing that message in their lives and for letting everybody know it with no walls of division, no separation of race, no separation of economics or position in society from the lowest to the highest. Everybody ought to know that. There's a passion for it. And they did. They let people know. Methodists were never criticized for their theology. They were never criticized for their social outreach or the lack of it, as you'll hear about next week. But here's what they were criticized for. The way they would let everybody know about it. It could create conflict then, and it still does today. Bishop Dick Wills used to be the pastor of Christ Methodist in Fort Lauderdale. He talks about a time when he and the leadership of the church got serious about reaching the people who were all around them and understanding we've got to do something different. So they changed one of their worship services to a different style, and they altered all of their Sunday morning services by 15 minutes. Have you ever heard of a church doing something so crazy as that? In this book, he tells how shortly after the change, one of the wealthiest members of the church came to see him, sat down in his office, and he said, I'm going to have to leave the church. And Dick Will said, well, can you help me understand why? And as they talked, he figured out what was going on. This man had a standing golf time, a tee time, every Sunday morning. And he said, now that they've changed the worship times, it's interrupting his golf time. And Dick Will said, wait a minute. Let me ask you something. If this change might help more of our neighbors around us hear the good news of Jesus Christ and experience hope in their life, can you not change your tee time by 15 minutes? And the man said, no. And he got up and walked out the door, and he never came back. I guess it's always been that way. That whenever you get serious about saying, we'll do whatever it takes, we'll do whatever it takes to make sure people know, that it can create some unrest. But that's in our DNA. That's who we are as Methodists. We do whatever it takes because we understand eternities are at stake. Jim Cimbala is the pastor of Brooklyn Tabernacle Church in New York City. He tells about finishing his last Easter service one year. Powerful services. He's greeted everybody. He's ready to walk away. He's just exhausted. And this man comes up to him, and he was obviously off the street. He could tell he had not bathed in who knows how long, and as he got close to him, he could begin to smell him. This combination of body odor, of urine, of alcohol. And he thought, really, Lord, really? People come in all the time needing money, wanting money. Somebody now wants to have more money to go buy wine with. Is that how I get to end Easter? The guy walked up and he said, tell me your name. He said, David. He said, how long have you been on the street? 6 years. Where'd you sleep last night? In an abandoned truck. How old are you, David? I'm 32. Okay, and he started reaching for his wallet. And David put out his hand. He said, no, I don't want any money. I heard your service this morning. And you said that there's new life in Jesus Christ. And I just want to know how to find that. Because I'm telling you, man, if I don't find it, I'm going to die out there. I'm not going to make it. All of a sudden, Jim Cimbala just started saying, God, forgive me. Oh, forgive me. Here I was just discounting this person and forgetting, oh, this is one of your children. And he started to cry. And this guy felt bad for the pastor, so he just walked up and started giving him a hug. And Jim said when the guy started hugging him, something happened. All of a sudden, his odor was not repulsive to him. And he felt God say to him, Jim, I need you to think that this aroma is a beautiful thing because I need you to be a pastor who cares about people like this. Jim, I depend on you. So the church helped him. They got him into a rehab program. He ended up coming to work on the maintenance staff. A year later, he asked this guy to share his testimony. And when he shared his testimony, Jim went, oh my gosh, this guy can preach. They sent him to seminary, and today he is the pastor of their campus church in New Jersey. Somebody who said, I didn't have long to live unless somebody gave me hope. Oh, my friends, you are God's invitation of hope. You are God's invitation of hope. Who is somebody you know? Who's somebody you can tell? Who's somebody you can invite? There's just too much at stake. And God lets people know about hope through people like you and me. Because deep down in our heart, we all yearn for it, don't we? We all want to know that life can be good and better, and we can find strength that we need. We all yearn for it. And often we find it when we give it away.